Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Hi there, everyone. It's 4 o'clock in New York, where the skies above us are hazy from those Canadian wildfires. We are all under air quality warnings. We're going to get to that story later in the broadcast, but we begin with what is shaping up to be a white-knuckle day for the disgraced, twice impeached, once indicted, now legally liable for sexual abuse ex-president, thanks to fast-moving developments in special counsel Jack Smith's criminal investigations, plural, into Donald Trump. Today, a federal grand jury in Miami is back in action, hearing witness testimony as part of the special counsel's investigation into whether the ex-president mishandled classified documents or obstructed government efforts to retrieve those classified documents after leaving office. And it was not just any witness. It was one of Trump's closest aides, a former Trump spokesman who now heads a pro-Trump super PAC. Washington Post reports this, quote, that prosecutors were at least partially interested in Taylor Budowich because of his role in an episode involving Trump in early 2022. After sending boxes of materials from his Mar-a-Lago home and private club to the National Archives, Trump drafted a lengthy statement saying he had given everything back to the federal government. But Budowich did not release Trump's statement after consulting with lawyers and advisors, at least some of whom did not believe that Trump had returned everything. Not a great day for the disgraced ex-president when folks who were in the proverbial room where it happened are before the grand jury. And he wasn't the only one. It comes on the heels of news that 24 of Trump's Secret Service agents had been subpoenaed or appeared before a federal grand jury in D.C. in the same classified documents investigation, as well as that bombshell reporting from the New York Times that none other than Mark Meadows, Trump's former chief of staff and unofficial consigliere, has testified as well. According to ABC News, Meadows, quote, answered questions on both Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election and Trump's alleged mishandling of classified documents while he was out of office. Oh, to be a fly on that wall. What did federal prosecutors ask Mark Meadows? The possibilities are endless. Maybe they asked about his role in turning over classified documents to the National Archives or his role with the fake elector scheme in Georgia. He traveled to Georgia. How odd for a White House chief of staff. Perhaps they asked about the 2,319 text messages that Mark Meadows turned over to the January 6th Select Committee before he stopped cooperating with it. It is fitting that with the one-year anniversary of the January 6th Select Committee's public hearings coming up, Mark Meadows is now back at the center of the national conversation. Meadows was the January 6th Select Committee's white whale, refusing to testify and cooperate, but casting a long shadow over virtually every second of those hearings. Listen to Cassidy Hutchinson.
And did you go back then up to the West Wing and tell Mr. Meadows about your conversation with Mr. Giuliani?
I did. After Mr. Giuliani had left the campus that evening, I went back up to our office and I found Mr. Meadows in his office on the couch. He was scrolling through his phone. I remember leaning against the doorway and saying, I had an interesting conversation with Rudy, Mark. Sounds like we're going to go to the Capitol. He didn't look up from his phone and said something to the effect of, there's a lot going on, Cass, but I don't know. Things might get real, real bad on January 6th.
I remember Pat saying something to the effect of, Mark, we need to do something more. They're literally calling for the vice president to be effing hung. And Mark had responded something to the effect of, you heard him, Pat. He thinks Mike deserves it. He doesn't think they're doing anything wrong. To which Pat said something, this is effing crazy. We need to be doing something more.
Ms. Hutchinson, did you have any conversations with Pat Cipollone about his concerns about the president going to the Capitol on January 6th?
On January 3rd, Mr. Cipollone had approached me knowing that Mark had raised the prospect of going up to the Capitol on January 6th. Mr. Cipollone and I had a brief private conversation where he said to me, we need to make sure that this doesn't happen. This would be legally a terrible idea for us. We have serious legal concerns if we go up to the Capitol that day.
Ms. Hutchison, did White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows ever indicate that he was interested in receiving a presidential pardon related to January 6th?
Mr. Meadows did seek that pardon. Yes, ma'am.
We may soon know why. Because, of course, we all know now, you don't seek a pardon if you think you're innocent. It's where we start today with the former lead investigator for the House January 6th Select Committee, Tim Hafey. Also joining us, New York Times reporter and MSNBC contributor, Katie Benner. Tim Hafey, the first time I had the pleasure of getting to talk to you after the Select Committee's work finished, I think I asked you what you would ask Mark Meadows. I have the same question today, but I'll add that now that we have such a mountain of evidence, in large part to the investigative work you and your colleagues on the 1-6 Select Committee did, is there any doubt in your mind that Mark Meadows is the one man who stood between Trump's enthusiasm for, quote, hanging Mike Pence and the legal concerns that were articulated in the sworn testimony by Cassidy Hutchinson and Pat Cipollone and others?
No doubt at all, Nicole. Look, he's at the center of everything. He is at the president's right hand throughout all of the relevant events, all of the multi prongs of the plot that the Select Committee articulated. Mark Meadows was right there. He was right there on January 6th, but he was right there in efforts to potentially change personnel at Justice. As your reporting just indicated, he went to Georgia before the certification after the election. He's involved in contact with members of Congress. He is such a vital player in all of this that if he's cooperating, and hard to say what he said in the grand jury, but if he's truthfully cooperating, it's a pretty significant step for the special counsel, a step beyond the Select Committee was able to take.
Now, I know we don't have a lot of visibility into what the circumstances are around his testimony before a grand jury, but the committee made clear, and Cassidy Hutchinson in that final comment talking about him seeking a pardon, Mark Meadows made clear that Mark Meadows thought Mark Meadows may have had criminal exposure, and that's why Mark Meadows, quote, sought a pardon. What are the scenarios for him cooperating now with Jack Smith's criminal probes?
Look, it's very common in a conspiracy investigation, and that's what this is. The special counsel is looking at a concerted action to disrupt the joint session. Some co-conspirators who have exposure have a strong incentive to cooperate with the government and reduce that exposure. So I don't know if there's been some sort of deal made between Meadows through counsel and Jack Smith and his team. You know, it's essentially not being charged or charged without a specific sentencing request in exchange for cooperation. That may be what's going on here. It may be that he's testifying in the hope that he isn't somehow implicated or indicted. My guess is there are extensive discussions between Meadows' counsel and the special counsel that sort of articulated the terms of his testimony, the expectations on both sides before he went in there and gave sworn testimony.
Tim, we know Kash Patel has been given some limited immunity in the documents probe. We know that that is a tool that this special counsel, Jack Smith, has used. Is it possible that Meadows' lawyer, George Terwilliger, was waiting for Georgia or the federal investigations to mature to a point where he understood his client's criminal exposure and waited to strike a deal? I mean, Mike Schmidt, who has one of the bylines on the story, talked about how this is one of the last people in this innermost circle that we're hearing about going before. I mean, he's coming after we heard about Mike Pence going before the grand jury.
Yeah, no question. Any good lawyer would want to have a clear sense from the government as to the status of his or her client before facilitating cooperation. So again, I'm sure there are extensive discussions. Mark Meadows has exposure. There's no question that his actions before and on January 6th give rise to participation in a conspiracy. Given that, that creates leverage for the special counsel to use that exposure as a means to get Mr. Meadows to cooperate. Now, it's a business transaction. Special counsel has to give up something to get that, and that is likely either immunity, like Mr. Patel has gotten, or maybe others, or again, the promise of conveying to the judge cooperation that would bear upon sentencing. We don't know what the terms are. We do know, though, again, Nicole, we keep saying it, he was right there at the center of the action in the room where it happened for multiple events. And that's why this is so potentially significant.
Let me show you. I mean, I think the most revealing evidence that was developed around Mark Meadows came from two sources in the congressional probe. It's from the trove of texts from Mark Meadows' phone that Adam Kinzinger described as the star witness, basically in absentia. And the second is the dramatic live and taped depositions of Cassidy Hutchinson. We'll go through all of it with you, Tim, but let me start with what to me sounded like knowledge of violence, knowledge of the specificity of the weapons that the insurrectionists were carrying. And as far as what was outward facing, not a real sense of action, not a real plan that was ever revealed through the congressional investigation. This is Cassidy Hutchinson on that.
What was Mark's reaction, Mr. Meadows' reaction, to this list of weapons that people had in the crowd?
When Tony and I went in to talk to Mark that morning, Mark was sitting on his couch and on his phone, which was something typical. And I remember Tony just got right into it. I was like, sorry, I just want to let you know, and informed him, like, this is how many people we have outside the mags right now. These are the weapons that we're known to have. It's possible he listed more weapons off that I just don't recall. And gave him a brief, but and concise explanation, but also fairly thorough. And I remember distinctly Mark not looking up from his phone. And I remember Tony finishing his explanation and it taking a few seconds for Mark to say something, to the point where I almost said, Mark, did you hear him? And then Mark chimed in and was like, all right, anything else? Still looking down at his phone. And Tony looked at me and I looked at Tony and Tony said, no, sir, do you have any questions? He's like, what are you hearing? And I looked at Tony and I was like, sir, he just told you about what was happening down at the rallies. And he was like, yeah, I know. And then he looked up and said, have you talked to the president? And Tony said, yes, sir, he's aware too. He said, all right, good.
So this felt in this presentation of evidence like the sort of two bookends of both Trump's knowledge and Meadows' knowledge of the violence that was planned and the capacity of violence in the form of the specific types of weapons they were carrying. It is sort of bolstered by the radio traffic, which isn't from Capitol Police. It's from presidential personal detail, which would only be tracking that if they plan to move the president. And then all of the evidence that the committee developed about the planned OTR and the difference between an OTR movement and a different kind of movement. Tell me how Meadows cracks the code on this evidence that was very much developed with what was available to the committee, but maybe not fully pierced without Meadows himself.
Yeah, so Meadows is the gatekeeper. He is the White House Chief of Staff. So Tony Ornato, who Cassidy Hutchinson referenced there, is another Deputy Chief of Staff. He works directly for Meadows. He's the person who liaisons with the Secret Service. He's actually a Secret Service agent who's detailed Ornato to the White House at the time. Meadows is the funnel through which information reaches the president. That's why Meadows' awareness is very, very close to the president's awareness. As Ms. Hutchinson said, he asks Tony Ornato, is the president aware? And Mr. Ornato says, yes. There was lots of information in the days leading up to January 6th about the prospect of weapons. We developed this really powerful vignette of the president himself on the night before, sort of opening the doors to the Oval Office and hearing the crowd that had gathered at Freedom Plaza the night before for another rally where Mike Flynn and Ali Alexander and a bunch of people are talking. And he says, these people are really angry. So the president is specifically aware from that testimony about this sort of rising sense of frustration and anger in the crowd. And then, Cole, we got all kinds of Teams messages, radio communication on the morning of January 6th that the Secret Service and other agencies gathered about people in the crowd with weapons, about weapons being stacked flagpoles and shields and clubs being stacked outside of the magnetometers at the White House. So it was very obvious to anyone, again, Meadows is the gatekeeper, about the presence of very dangerous implements and weapons at the Ellipse on January 6th. So if he is cooperative, if he is testifying, his awareness of all of that information about dangers, very specific danger presented by the crowd, and the president's awareness of that, really significant about the president's intent.
And Tim, he also had a foot both in the, as the White House chief of staff, obviously, one foot in the Oval Office, the other foot in the command center at the Willard. I mean, what questions do you want to know? I think it was Congressman Jamie Raskin who led the hearing about the extremists. It felt like evidence was developed connecting the actions of the extremists that day to the desires of the president and his invitations to, quote, come to D.C. It will be wild on the 19th and afterward. But what would you need to know from Meadows to sort of firmly connect those two dots?
Yeah. Again, as a gatekeeper, I would want to know to whom is the gate swinging open? And if Mark Meadows is in communication with not just Secret Service agents and Tony Arnotto, but Steve Bannon or Roger Stone or people with direct contact with extremist groups, that would be hugely important. We developed some information that Meadows at one point planned to go to the Willard on January 5th, on the night before. He did not end up going, but there was at least some contemplation that he would, to that sort of suite of rooms or war room where Giuliani and Bernie Kerik and others were, but also Roger Stone was actually staying there. So we don't know exactly if he served a role of sort of connectivity between people who have direct communication with the extremist groups and the president, but that would be obviously something as the gatekeeper that Jack Smith will want to focus on.
Katie Benner, Tim mentioned this sort of inside-outside role that Mark Meadows played. This is the outside game. The inside game was the DOJ coup plot, which I know you've reported on extensively. This is from one of the text messages that Mark Meadows turned over in his pre-stonewalling phase with the congressional investigation. It's from Scott Perry. Perry writes to Meadows, quote, Mark, you should call Jeff. I just got off the phone with him, and he explained to me why the principal deputy won't work, especially with the FBI. They will view it as not having the authority to enforce what needs to be done. Meadows, quote, I got it. I think I understand. Let me work on the deputy position. Clearly, at least in this message, expressing a willingness and, I don't know, I would describe it as an enthusiasm to, quote, work on the deputy position. This was evidence that made clear that nothing less than a coup atop DOJ was planned by Trump and Meadows. Just talk about the connective tissue that Meadows can provide to what was developed by the congressional probe, but still lacking a real direct tie. I guess not lacking many ties, but lacking some of the scenes where Meadows and Trump are talking about this specifically.
Yeah, so Mark Meadows, he's saying, I'm going to work on the Justice Department and the officials there to try to get them on board. They were supposed to be sort of the official mouthpiece for this plot to say untruthfully that the election had not been won by Joe Biden in key swing states, that there had been massive fraud, and that there needed to be a delay so that those votes could be counted again. So the Justice Department needed to be the part of the government to say this because it still had credibility. So you see Meadows here relaying to a Trump ally, I will work on them to get them to be part of this larger plan that we've developed. Now, what's interesting, there are a couple of things interesting here. One, of course, they needed a more credible outlet to give voice to this lie, because so much credibility had been blown by people like Rudy Giuliani, it was not going to be credible. But two, you see Meadows in a coordinating role. So there are a couple of things that I'm sure Tim could speak to this better than I could, but I'd be really curious to know from Meadows, when you did this, was this your plan and was this your initiative? And did you truly think that the election had been overturned despite all the evidence to the contrary that Justice Department officials themselves were giving to you? Or did Donald Trump direct you? Because if it was your plan, Mark Meadows, well, then the buck stops with you and you have culpability perhaps for a large plan to overthrow a free and fair election. Or did you do it at somebody else's behest and was that person the former president? And I think that that's the question that at least we had when we were reporting these things out, as we saw that people were certainly being directed, and some of the directions seemed to be coming from the White House, but it always seemed to stop just shy of Donald Trump vis-a-vis what we were able to get in texts and documents and interviews.
Tim, you want to take a stab at answering where the evidence points in your mind?
Yeah, just to pick up on what Katie said, Nicole. So Scott Perry is really crucial in the DOJ story. Congressman Perry from Pennsylvania, former member of the Freedom Caucus, as was Mark Meadows. His contact in the White House is Mark Meadows. So Scott Perry, who knows this guy, Jeff Clark, and is working on these sort of bogus theories of election fraud, proposes Jeff Clark's installation as acting attorney general. Bill Barr wasn't going to misuse the Justice Department. Neither was his successor, Jeff Rosen. So Perry generates this idea of personnel change to install Jeff Clark. And he goes to Mark Meadows, his old buddy from the Freedom Caucus, who works directly as the president's chief of staff. So Meadows is right in the center of the possible personnel change at Justice, just as he is in all of the prongs of this plot, the plot in Georgia, because he goes down there, contact with members of Congress, all of that. Mark Meadows is right in the center as the gatekeeper to the president and as a connector. Jack Smith will absolutely, as Katie said, want to develop all of the DOJ story from Meadows' perspective.
Katie, he's also Trump's guy in Georgia. He travels to Georgia after Joe Biden has won the election. And there's all sorts of evidence developed by the committee. I know there's some evidence that Senate Judiciary started developing even before the committee was formed about the coup plot at DOJ. And it includes Jeffrey Clark. It includes this letter. And it includes a trip by Meadows to Georgia.
Mm-hmm. Each piece of this seems so wild and like a big standalone story in and of itself. Trying to overthrow the Justice Department, for example, who would have thought? And yet, these things are all simply a piece of a larger plan to use several states in order to delegitimize the results of the election. So Georgia, again, was a test case. So inside the Justice Department, when officials are arguing about whether or not to send a letter to Georgia state officials saying that the Justice Department believes there's been fraud, even though top DOJ officials knew that was not true, when Jeffrey Clark, who was the official inside of DOJ who wanted to do this, when he was presenting this as an option, he kept saying, this will be basically a test case. And there are other states that we could send a similar letter to. Georgia was sort of, I think Georgia is interesting because it's where you see this larger plan begin to be activated. And you see pushback from state officials, you see pushback from the Justice Department on it. But Georgia wasn't the end all and be all. They wanted to do more. It's just where things started. So imagine if Georgia officials had not pushed back. Imagine if Justice Department officials had not pushed back. Imagine if department officials had not fought with Trump over this and fought for their jobs in order to stop it. It would have been the first state to fall. It wouldn't have been what we know of it now, which is the state that all of these people in the Trump orbit were simply focused on. It's because that's what they were focused on initially. And so again, when you see that kind of large sprawling plan that involves members of Congress, people who worked at the White House, people outside of the White House, and people who worked in the Justice Department, you have to wonder who is coordinating them all. Right now, to Tim's point, the evidence suggests the person who had a hand in every single one of those pieces is Mark Meadows. And I just wonder if Mark Meadows is going to want investigators to leave with the impression that indeed he was the coordinator of all of this, or if he'll want to say somebody else was directing him.
What, Tim, I mean, we have to sneak in a break, but what do you think the answer is? I mean, who do you think he could be helpful in helping to make a case against? Is it Trump? Is it Eastman? Is it Clark? Is it Rudy? Is it all of the above?
Yes, 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 and yes. Absolutely. Mark Meadows has direct communications with Giuliani, with Eastman, with Clark, with Georgia officials. As Katie was just saying, he goes to Georgia. He actually observes a recount facility. He calls the Secretary of State's chief voter fraud investigator. He's on that notorious January 3rd call with Brad Raffensperger. He's actually on the call when it happened. So he's right in the center of that. And he, on January 4th and 5th, has conversations with John Eastman that Pat Cipollone is excluded from. Remember, Pat Cipollone said that he was going to attend a meeting with the president, the vice president, John Eastman, and he's essentially not there. And he couldn't tell us why, but we believe it was because he disagreed and the president didn't want that. Mark Meadows is there for that. So, yes, he has information about a number of other co-conspirators, not simply the president. And he has really important evidence for Georgia. To get back to Katie's point, Fani Willis, I believe he's testified in the Georgia grand jury. He would have very direct information that might bear upon possible charges that she's evaluating in Georgia.
We've been drilling down on January 6th. Obviously, what we have both of you, we want to drill down on Jack Smith's other investigation. As ABC News has reported, Mark Meadows also answered questions about that. He was in the room where the packing happened as well. So no one's going anywhere. Much more on this. Plus, lonely and self-serving, breathtaking grift. Those are words that were uttered by former Trump super ally, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, to describe his one-time buddy and ally Donald Trump. The crowded 2024 GOP field is getting more crowded, but there's really only one person calling it like it really is with Donald Trump. We'll show that to you. And later in the broadcast, more on the possible looming indictment from the special counsel, a live report from outside the Florida courthouse, all those stories and more when Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
We're back with Tim Havey and Katie Benner, two of the foremost experts on the evidence that has been developed and the questions that remain for Trump and the insiders in both these probes. Let me switch gears to the documents investigation and share with both of you what the Washington Post is reporting this afternoon. Quote, Justice Department prosecutors are planning to bring a significant portion of any charges stemming from the possible mishandling of classified documents at Mar-a-Lago at a nearby federal court in South Florida. That's according to people familiar with the matter. The legal rationale for such a move is that the bulk of the conduct at issue in the investigation occurred in the Southern District of Florida, in and around Trump's Palm Beach residence and private club. Even if much of the investigation has been handled by a grand jury in Washington, D.C., these people said. That approach by prosecutors does not rule out the possibility of some charges, such as perjury or false statements, being filed in the nation's capital in connection with the grand jury appearances of law enforcement interviews that took place there. Tim Havey, is this a rather normal thing, or what do you see that maybe we don't see with this news?
So hearsay is admissible in a grand jury, so it doesn't really matter if you present evidence to multiple grand juries because it can all be summarized for the grand jury that ultimately returns an indictment. Here you have witnesses in different places, and for lots of reasons, it might be more convenient to call a witness in a grand jury in Florida, a different witness in a grand jury in Washington. It all has to come together somewhere. Total speculation here, but it may be that some of this is the department thinking about public criticism or legitimacy of a case, that if they bring a case in Florida, that sort of rebuts the criticism that this is sort of D.C. and everybody in D.C. is out to get the former president. They bring the case in his own backyard in a relatively conservative state like Florida. There may be some public perception that it's more legitimate. They believe, obviously, if they issue an indictment, they believe in their case and believe they can prove their case anywhere. Maybe they think it actually has more credibility if it's brought in a jurisdiction in which the former president has more supporters. Again, I don't know that. I have no inside information about this. I'm just putting my former prosecutor hat on, speculating as to what factors might influence the venue for a possible criminal charge.
I mean, there are a million different ways to slice that if that turns out to be true, how pervasive the political climate is in terms of calculations and considerations at DOJ. But I guess the other way to look at it, Katie, would be the strength of the evidence that's been developed. Just take me inside. I mean, I know you and your colleagues are all over this story. The latest reporting comes in the form of Maggie Haberman's Twitter thread. She's reporting that Trump told her a few minutes ago, this is about an hour old, that he's not been told he's getting indicted, which is contradicted by Trump's own Truth Social feed, which has been in all caps for about 72 hours, screaming about fascists, and I won't dignify the rest of it. What is your sense of the state of anxiety in Trump's inner circle?
Well, the state of anxiety is high, and we've seen this multiple times, both with the Mueller investigation and with both impeachments, as he was waiting to be impeached. He senses danger, and he flips out. He makes contradictory statements. He says he's about to be punished. He says he's not about to be punished. So I don't think this is necessarily, I don't think that Trump's state of mind should indicate to the rest of the world what is about to happen. I think it's more just about his state of mind. Interestingly, on Tim's point on Florida, I just wanted to note that Florida prosecutors and investigators have been working on the Mar-a-Lago case for a very long time. And when Jack Smith became the special counsel, some of the very first prosecutors who he met with as he was being briefed up were in Florida, because so much of the action in terms of the question of whether or not Trump obstructed justice, obstructed the investigation, that action happened in Florida at Mar-a-Lago. So Florida has been a player in this investigation all along, just pretty quietly, and has only shown up in a couple of different news reports. But prosecutors in Florida have been along for this entire journey and have provided key evidence to Jack Smith. So it wouldn't be unusual for him to think that part of the case we brought there. Also, you know, people who work on who do criminal appeals work, there are some folks like that on Jack Smith's team. They'll be really cognizant of the, you know, the appeals process, because no matter who wins or loses a case, if a case is brought either side, I think is pretty likely to appeal. And whether or not there be some sort of argument about venue or the Justice Department monkeying around with venue, you know, like, so there'd be a robust conversation about that, too. But whether or not we're going to see Donald Trump charged tomorrow, I think Donald Trump's own mind about that is going to be changing pretty much every minute as he feels increasing anxiety about whether or not he'll be indicted again.
And on the Mark Meadows being before Jack Smith's grand jury on this probe, as well as January 6th, Tim, I mean, Mark Meadows is the guy who, and this is what the Times reported, his attorney, George Terwilliger, said, quote, without commenting on whether or not Meadows has testified before the grand jury or in any other proceedings, Meadows has maintained a commitment to tell the truth where he has a legal obligation to do so. So if he's before a grand jury, I take that to mean that his lawyer, George Terwilliger, is only staying the course because his client has committed to, quote, tell the truth. If he's telling the truth about the documents, he's sort of a one-man debunking operation of all of this malarkey about imagining things declassified. Trump debunks it as well in this tape that we know that Jack Smith has developed, where he ruffles papers and says, can't show you that because it's classified. But Meadows was in the residence, ostensibly, when Trump is packing his documents. Meadows was involved in the 9 or 11 months when Trump and Nara are going back and forth before DOJ and the FBI get involved to try to retrieve classified documents. Meadows knows everything about what he took, what was classified, what wasn't, and I could probably tell an interesting story about why he basically abandons that effort at some juncture when Trump brings in this team of lawyers who have now also become witnesses against Trump in the documents probe.
Yeah, it sounds like he's a bridge from before the end of the administration with respect to the preservation of presidential records to what happened after the president left office with respect to that tape recording of Trump acknowledging that he possessed something classified and the process by which presidential documents continued to be transferred to the National Archives and discussions with them. So it sounds like he sort of straddles both investigations, right? These are distinct investigations that the special counsel is conducting. I expect that if there are charges, they would be separate. They would not all be in the same case. There's the Jan 6 obstruction of an official proceeding case, and then there's the Mar-a-Lago possession of documents. And Mark Meadows very well may have information about both. we developed a lot of evidence about a very, very lax approach to adherence to the Presidential Records Act. We talked to a lot of witnesses who said that there was very little rigor on that process, that the president would sometimes tear things up and throw them in the trash, and aides would sort of fish them out and tape pieces of paper together. We actually got some stuff from the archives that looked to have been pieced back together from pieces. Cassidy Hutchinson talked about Mark Meadows burning documents in his fireplace. So talk about a lax approach to the adherence with the Presidential Records Act. Can't get more lax than that. So he's in charge of that whole process as chief of staff. The legal imperative, the people's documents, information about the official business of the administration. And from what lots of witnesses said, that was not something that was front and center in his mind, and therefore not in the minds of lots of other people. They'd want to talk to him about all of that in his role as chief of staff.
I mean, Tim, could that speak to some criminal exposure on the documents front, too, if there was part of a conspiracy to obstruct the government's efforts to have these documents returned to it?
Yes, absolutely. If he has evidence that the president is mindful of the fact that these are clearly presidential records, remember, they don't even have to be classified for it to be a crime. They have to be the possession of presidential records. It's worse and a different crime if they are classified. And if he has evidence that the president mindfully maintained those documents, aware that they were supposed to be turned in and he hadn't done that, then absolutely. Now, does he himself participate in that? Again, you have to wonder whether or not he's a co-conspirator in both of these cases. And if so, if his cooperation is immunized or an attempt for leniency. Again, I don't know the facts about the Mar-a-Lago matter. That all happened, you know, after the administration ended and was outside the scope of the Select Committee. But from what we do know from our investigation, again, very, very lax adherence to the stringent requirements of the maintenance of classified and presidential records.
Tim Hafey and Katie Benner are two of the foremost experts on this chapter in American political history, and the actors, thank you very much for starting us off today. We're so grateful. Up next for us, Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump, intent on rehabilitating their reputations post-Trump presidency, were called out bigly last night for their big, breathtaking grift, a $2 billion payout from the Saudis. Chris Christie making that his opening message, his opening salvo in his campaign for the American presidency. We'll talk about his entry into the 2024 primary race and his clear intent to burn it all down when it comes to the house that Trump built. That's next.
The grift from this family is breathtaking. It's breathtaking. Jared Kushner and Ivanka Kushner walk out of the White House and months later get $2 billion from the Saudis. $2 billion from the Saudis. You think it's because he's some kind of investing genius? Or do you think it's because he was sitting next to the President of the United States for 4 years doing favors for the Saudis? That's your money. That's your money he stole and gave it to his family. You know what that makes us? A banana republic. That's what it makes us. So he may get 30% again. I'm not sure. Maybe he'll get more. Maybe he'll get less. But let me tell you what he'll know in 2024 that he had no idea of in 2016. He's in for a fight to get it.
That was new. And for the record, literally nobody thinks that Jared Kushner is an investing genius. That's former New Jersey Republican Governor Chris Christie. And that was his opening message. He's officially thrown his hat in the ring to run for president in the Republican primary in 2024. He came out of the gate swinging last night at Donald Trump, at Jared Kushner, at Jared Kushner's wife, Ivanka Kushner. In a launch event that was in New Hampshire, Christie took aim at the field's frontrunner in a way that nobody else has done as of yet. And it is a real turn, an evolution, if you will, for the man who advised Donald Trump throughout his presidency and who was among the first. I think he was the first establishment Republican to endorse Donald Trump in the 2016 Republican primary. Now, make no mistake, he faces a very steep climb in an already crowded primary, and Christie is not near the top of the field in current polling. But he made clear that he is going to do everything he can to burn Trump's political house down to the ground. Watch.
A lonely, self-consumed, self-serving mirror hog is not a leader. The person I am talking about, who is obsessed with the mirror, who never admits a mistake, who never admits a fault, and who always finds someone else and something else to blame for whatever goes wrong, but finds every reason to take credit for anything that goes right, is Donald Trump.
Joining our coverage, editor-at-large of The Bulwark, MSNBC contributor Charlie Sykes. Also joining us, the founder of Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America, the host of the Independent Americans podcast. Paul Rykoff is here. I want to show you guys one more piece of sound, because Christie's campaign is very different from Christie's last campaign, where he did not criticize Donald Trump, and he was the first to endorse him. It earned him the ire of Mitt Romney in 2016 and others. But Christie isn't just teeing off on Donald Trump. He's teeing off on the rest of the field. Let me show you this, Charlie.
We have pretenders all around us who want to tell you, pick me, because I'm kind of like what you picked before, but not quite as crazy. But I don't want to say his name, because for these other pretenders, he is, for those of you who read the Harry Potter books, like Voldemort. He is he who shall not be named.
Charlie Sykes, Chris Christie is not at the top of the Republican primary polls. He is, I think, viewed as a long shot candidate, but he is the only one running like this.
Well, let's stipulate that he really doesn't have a shot, that he's not going to win this nomination, and that he has a lot of baggage, including the way that he enabled Donald Trump. But damn, that was some impressive political performance art there. And I have to say that we knew that that he was going to come in and that he was going to, you know, punch up to Donald Trump. I don't think what we realized was quite how spicy he was going to be. He's made it very clear, I think, last night that he's going to leave nothing on the field. He's going to say all the things that other Republicans have said in private, but he's going to say it in public, and he's going to do it as forcefully as possible. So this is the difference between the 2016 campaign. I mean, I still have the PTSD about what happened, but no one in the Republican ranks took on Donald Trump from the beginning with this specificity, going after his lies, his duplicity, his position on policy issues, and going after the grifting in the family. That basically shows that he's not going to be ramping up to go scorched earth. He went from day one. So again, he's not going to win this election, but there's a real chance, Nicole, that he could turn out to be one of the most consequential candidates in 2024. Because if Donald Trump can be taken down in a Republican primary, it's going to be by somebody like Chris Christie. And I don't know whether he influenced Mike Pence, but Mike Pence was also surprisingly spicy and aggressive in going after Donald Trump. So it does feel as if we have at least entered at the tentatively the beginning of what might possibly be a new phase of this campaign.
I never disagree with Charlie, but I don't know that I would call Mike Pence spicy today or ever. here's the other piece. The political analysis gets stuck in this sort of lazy, calcified, I'm not accusing you of this, Charlie, but this well, he can't win, so why? Liz Cheney isn't in Congress, but she did a whole lot of words I can't use here, a ton of damage to Trump and the Republicans ahead of the ever important midterms. She helped create democracy voters. She helped tell a story using all Trump supporting Republicans of the danger Trump uniquely and specifically and currently and in the future poses to U.S. democracy.
Yes. Christie's right, but he's also complicit. Like, he made this mess, and now he's trying to ride in on some kind of white horse like he's the man of integrity to try to clean it up. The message is right. In that people are fed up with the grift. They're fed up with the lack of integrity. They're fed up with the sellouts. We'll, I'm sure, talk about LIV Golf and what's happened there. So he's right on the substance, and he's right in taking on Trump. He's just the wrong guy to do it, because Americans are looking for authenticity, and he doesn't bring it. He looks like a guy who's willing to change his jersey depending upon the way the wind blows. So Christie can score some points. Can he he take down Trump? No, Trump's better at this than he is. But if they all gang up together and it sets a tone, they can start to chip away at Godzilla over time. I still think Trump's going to prevail. But it does also help the Republican Party appeal to independents. It makes them sound more moderate. It makes them sound more sane. And it makes them sound more patriotic. Because there are a lot of people in this country who are truly patriotic, who aren't worried about rainbow flags on beer cans, but they're worried about selling the White House. And that's the bigger issue. To the Saudis and any number of other people, apparently, in the next couple of weeks. We'll find out.
Charlie, I'm going to give you a chance to come back at me on everything I just said. I have to sneak in a quick break first. We'll all be right back.
Okay.
We're back with Charlie Sykes and Paul Rykoff. Charlie, I feel like I used all of your brilliant analysis to tee off and make a different point, but I want to come back to you on both your Pence argument and this idea that we don't know what we don't know. It is a fluid political moment. I mean, we have an unprecedented day here in New York City where I don't know that the air quality, even in the days after.
Sign.
Right. I mean, it was localized in and around 9/11, but it's apocalyptic. It's destabilizing. It's scary. And there are precious few sort of trusted voices. We don't know what we don't know about what the contours of this contest will be.
That's right. And I want to make it very clear that, you know, we don't always get to choose our heroes and we don't get to choose our allies. And so I do think that if nobody else is going to do it, then Chris Christie is the right person to do it right now, because he's looking around going, who else is going to say these things? I mean, I would love for Liz Cheney to be up there. But let's be honest about this, that I wasn't trying to do the punditry about the horse race. I'm saying that even though he's not going to win this election, I think he's going to be consequential. I think this is important. I think it's also welcome. And I also think it's going to put pressure on other candidates to say, well, what are you going to say about all of this? If you want to take down Donald Trump, you have to take down Donald Trump. Why are you not saying the kinds of things that Chris Christie is saying? I think it's going to be quite entertaining, and I think it's going to be quite worthwhile listening to.
And just to build on Charlie's point, I think Chris Christie is saying things that a lot of people have known and said privately. And I think he's going to force some of them out of the shadows. And some of them are very comfortable in the shadows. But this $2 billion that Jared Kushner got from the Saudis when Steve Mnuchin, who's got a lot better investment record than Jared Kushner got, was talked about at a much higher volume privately than was ever really noted or reported. It may force Democrats even to open an investigation into Kushner.
I don't think Christie's going to be our hero, but he can break the seal and he can open up the conversation, especially in Republican circles, especially in moderate circles. And he's a Jersey guy, right? It's a Jersey guy getting down the mud with Trump, fighting on his kind of turf in his way, scrapping it up. And I think that will score points and do some damage on Trump. But I think to your larger point, we were talking about in the break, people are looking for steadiness. People are looking for integrity at a time when it feels like everything's under attack and everything is for sale. The Saudis sold out America, attacking America, and PGA sold out America to the Saudis on D-Day. And spit in the face of 9/11 first responders who are right now in New York suffering with this smoke. It feels like 9/11 in this city.
Yeah.
I'm talking to 9/11 first responders like myself who are really feeling this. And we're reminded of what it was like on 9/11. Now the country's kind of feeling what that was like. And we're looking for leaders who can take us through it, who can meet the moment, who can just manage crisis and manage fear and take us forward. Chris Christie's not going to be the guy to do it. I think other leaders will rise up, but I think he can set a better tone. And you can set a tone. We can all set a tone of steadiness and unity.
I need to have you stick around. We're at the end of this hour. I need you to stay over the top because you were the first person to put LIV Golf on our radar. There's been a big development, and I just want to button that piece up with you if you can stick around through the break. Charlie Sykes, your insights are always appreciated and invaluable around here, and I didn't mean to disagree with you on any of them. Thank you very much for joining our coverage today. Much more on our top story straight ahead, all eyes on the federal courthouse in Florida. We'll head live to Miami next. Don't go anywhere.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
Meadows is our star witness, even though he didn't end up cooperating and he's in contempt. His initial tranche of text messages he gave us were gold mines, and they really helped us to develop a lot of leads. He's always been a backstabber. I mean, you just read the story about, you know, with John Boehner, where Mark Meadows literally got on his knees and cried for forgiveness for John Boehner. And then a few weeks later, stabbed him in the back again. I think he's just power driven. I think all he cares about is power. All he cares about is a title. And you can convince yourself, if you're you think you're a moral man, that, boy, I just need to, the end justifies the means. I got to do whatever it takes.
Hi again, everyone. It's 5 o'clock in New York. Former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows was, in the words of Adam Kinzinger, the January 6th committee's star witness without ever stepping foot into a committee room. So just imagine what members of the federal grand jury and special counsel Jack Smith's investigations are thinking right now. Now that we know Meadows has testified in Smith's twin probes, although we do not know his level of cooperation. Meadows became such a key part of the January 6th Select Committee's investigation due to the thousands of text messages he handed over before he abruptly stopped cooperating with that investigation. Text messages that revealed that in nearly every flashpoint of the ex-president's effort to overturn his defeat in 2020, Mark Meadows was the quarterback. He was the one receiving text after text during the Capitol riot from Fox News anchors telling him to have the president go on TV or go to the briefing room and call off the coup, the insurrection, the violence. Mark Meadows was in receipt of those. Who did Trump's own son, Donald Trump Jr., text when he was worried that the insurrection would, quote, ruin his father's legacy? He texted Mark Meadows. Who engaged with Congressman Scott Perry about wild conspiracies of a rigged election, including that Italian satellites had switched votes from Trump to Biden? It was Mark Meadows. Now, who did Ginny Thomas, the wife of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, text when she wanted Trump to fight the election results? It was, of course, you guessed it, Mark Meadows. Of course, it wasn't only the copious text messages that revealed Meadows' deep involvement in every aspect of the attempted coup. There was another White House voice on the line when Trump pressured Georgia's Secretary of State to find votes that would overturn his loss, and it was, you guessed it, Mark Meadows. According to the stunning testimony by his own deputy, who said, among many things, it was Mark Meadows who knew that things were going to get, quote, real bad on the 6th. According to reporting from ABC News, Meadows also answered questions in front of the grand jury about Smith's other probe, the one looking into Trump's handling of classified documents at Mar-a-Lago. Today, updates out of Miami. In that case, first, the grand jury heard testimony from former Trump aide Taylor Budowich, who was asked about a past public statement he had made on behalf of Donald Trump. And second, the Washington Post reports that DOJ prosecutors are planning to bring a significant portion of any charges in that case to a federal court in South Florida rather than Washington, D.C. That's according to people familiar with the matter. Monumental updates in the special counsel's twin probes is where we begin this hour with some of our favorite reporters and friends. MSNBC legal analyst Lisa Rubin is live for us outside the courthouse in Miami, and former top Justice Department official and MSNBC legal analyst Andrew Weissman is back. Democratic strategist and director of the public policy program at Hunter College, Basil Smichel, is here at the table. Paul Breitkopf is still with us. Andrew Weissman, you rocked our world at the beginning of the week with your declarative statements about the inevitability of charges and the potential timing of them. We come to you first for an update on what you see that maybe we don't see as a former prosecutor and senior FBI and DOJ official.
Well, I think the part that seems most revelatory in the last 24 hours is the location where Lisa is right now, which is, until recently, everyone was focused on Washington, D.C. for where these charges will be brought. And now, at least the reporting is, and it seems fairly solid, is that there certainly is a lot of activity in Florida. For viewers who might be thinking, who cares as long as there are charges, whether it's D.C. or Florida, why does the venue matter? It really could make a huge difference. The jury pool is different. The judges are different. And remember, this is the place where you had a judge like Eileen Cannon, who really slowed things down and was making quite sort of erroneous rulings, so much so that the circuit court, the appellate court, had to reverse her, not once, but twice. Also, D.C. is a location where the court is very used to dealing with classified information. There's an expertise there. So in terms of speed, getting this case to trial, the venue matters. So it's something that I think everyone's very focused on is where this case will ultimately be brought. But as you've noted in the last hour and in the intro, Nicole, there's just more and more signs that the case is coming to fruition.
So, Lisa, I don't know that we could have a better setup for your report than Andrew Weissen saying you are where it all appears to be happening, at least today. At least today. We don't know what we don't know. But take us inside Taylor Budowich, what we know about his presence today and what we know about his role in the documents, particularly in the what seems most likely the investigation into the obstructive efforts by Trump to try to foil the government's work.
Well, Taylor was in the grand jury for roughly an hour today, Nicole. When we first spotted him this morning, however, we were surprised to see that he was the witness that print outlets have been reporting would be testifying in Miami this week. However, when you take into consideration that Taylor Budowich was the former president's spokesperson until September of 2022, it all begins to make sense because, as you noted in your setup, Taylor Budowich made a series of statements about the investigation that started with the National Archives to recover those documents and then morphed into a criminal investigation with the FBI and the Department of Justice. And in particular, what we understand is that Taylor Budowich was examined about a particular statement that he made in February of 2022. After Trump returned the first 15 boxes to the National Archives, the Department of Justice has evidence that Trump's initial draft of that statement was far more declarative about returning all and any classified documents. After consulting with lawyers and advisors, Taylor Budowich dialed that back some. And the prosecutors wanted to know today, why? What did you know at the time? What were your communications with Trump? What were your communications with other people? But most importantly, this suggests that the focus here in Florida is not just on lower level people in Trump's orbit, but squarely on the former president himself. What did he know about the classified documents in his possession? And was he advised by folks that he couldn't say what he wanted to say? Because indeed, he still had documents that he shouldn't have had in his possession. Nicole.
I mean, Andrew Weissen, the list of documented and investigated episodes of Trump telling people to just say things to the press is so copious. We have to go all the way to Kyiv, to Zelensky, just say you're going to open. I think it was Gordon Sondland who testified that Trump wanted him to just say that you were going to investigate the Bidens, to Trump on the phone with Rosen and Donahue saying, just say it's corrupt. My Republican congressional allies will do the rest. To the Mueller report, volume two, I think it's obstructive act three or four, where Don McGahn is asked to just say it wasn't true that he wanted Mueller fired. I mean, you can pull back the layers in multiple efforts to investigate Trump's conduct. And every one of them holds an episode of Trump asking someone to just say something to the press that isn't true.
Absolutely. And it's the veneer that Donald Trump was looking for. And this goes back to, as you note, the first impeachment. And this is, I have to say, this is where what Mark Meadows has to say, this is just so important. As you noted in your discussion with Tim Hafey, he could really be like the flipping to go into my, you know, New York organized crime origins as a prosecutor. This could be like flipping Sammy Gravano, the underboss of the Gambino family, with respect to John Gotti. In other words, this is the number two who, even more than Mike Pence, was exactly where you would want a witness to be. But the critical thing that we do not know is whether Mark Meadows is going to say, I had all of the same knowledge as the former president, and I knew what we were saying and doing was wrong. that this was something that was a crime, this is why I asked for a pardon? Or is he going to be essentially an exculpatory witness who's saying, I knew everything the president knew, but I had a good faith belief. I didn't think I was doing anything wrong. So he is just a very important witness as to which way he's going. Obviously, if he has struck a plea deal and he has pled guilty and is cooperating because he is hoping for a better deal at sentencing, that is, you know, that is not just a nail in the coffin. That is the end for Donald Trump. But if he was immunized, where there was, you don't know exactly what he was going to say, and he's put in the grand jury, then that is something where we really have to wait and see just how much Mark Meadows is willing to say what I did and what everyone else was doing was wrong, and we knew it at the time, which will, of course, end any sort of future that Mark Meadows has in politics. I mean, he will be, you know, anathema to any sort of right thinking Democrat or Republican, just any American patriot.
Andrew Weissman, we really haven't started this show yet until someone makes a Gambino or a Stringer Bell reference. And so now we can begin. Let me press you on your Meadows point. I mean, this is from the transcript of Cassidy Hutchinson's testimony. I don't know that we ever saw this in her tape depot. But Liz Cheney is asking about the destruction of documents in the context of the congressional probe into 1/6. And Cheney says, how frequently did you see him do it? Cassidy Hutchinson said, I mean, it's hard. I want to say once a week or twice. I can recall specific times that I did, maybe a dozen, maybe just over a dozen. But this is over a period of December through mid-January, which is when we started lighting the fireplace. What? Cheney, did he explain what he was doing? Hutchinson, I never asked. Cheney, do you recall timeframes? So were these after particular meetings or specific issues or documents? Cassidy Hutchinson, quote, he was in meetings all day long, so it was after meetings. I don't know specific documents. I know maybe 3 or 4 times, maybe 2 and 4 times he had Mr. Perry in his office right before he burned things. Do you know what Mr. Perry was talking to him about? Hutchinson, election issues. Cheney, anything more specific than that? Hutchinson, quote, the vice president's role on January 6th. I'm trying to think the first time Mr. Perry was at the White House with all of this, mid-December, I believe. Mr. Perry started coming to meet with Mr. Meadows about what he believed could happen on January 6th. And they were preparing various PowerPoints and he would bring physical material. So Richard Painter was my ethics advisor when I worked in the West Wing. And I think Richard Painter would have taken me to jail himself if I'd ripped up or burned anything while I worked in the White House. This is the White House chief of staff burning things once or twice a week after meetings. This is in and of itself, an unbelievable account from his most senior, his closest aide. What do you think the odds are that some immunity was given to Mr. Meadows before he testified, before Jack Smith's probe into both the documents and January 6th?
Some sort of deal had to have been reached. Either it is one where he was given immunity, or it is one where he had to plead guilty to something and he is hoping for what's called a 5K letter, a sentencing letter to the judge for leniency, given his cooperation. It's one of the two. But the key for immunity is the discussion prior to immunity being afforded. The way this works is his defense lawyer would tell Jack Smith, these are the kinds of things that you could expect to hear from Mark Meadows if you immunize him, because you don't want to essentially buy a pig in a poke. You want to know if you immunize somebody, I want to have a sense of what that person's going to say. And obviously, by the way, if you get immunity and then you go in and lie, you still can be prosecuted for that lie. So if you have a good defense counsel and you are given immunity, that defense counsel is going to be saying, Mark, this is your get out of jail free card. You did something wrong. You have to own up to it. And if you start fudging, you are risking criminal liability. And Nicole, you've outlined just some of the many ways that Mark Meadows, if he's going to say, I didn't do anything wrong, that there's no culpability here, it's going to be fraught in terms of going down that road. But that's the issue, is usually with white collar cases, getting somebody to say what I used to call the W word, I did something wrong, is very hard because it's going to become public. It will be splashed all over the news. Your family, the entire nation is going to know that. But in this kind of case, you know, given the amount of ammunition that Jack Smith has to use to say, look, you need to do that because otherwise we will be making a criminal case against you. That is the pressure that Jack has to hold Mark Meadows to tell the truth. Obviously, the downside is that you have somebody who otherwise should be prosecuted and should suffer the consequences of engaging in that kind of conduct. You know, after all, he was the chief of staff to the leader of the free world. And if he is going to say that he engaged in obstruction in trying to overturn an election and did so knowingly, I mean, those are the most horrendous crimes that you can imagine. I mean, Nicole, you worked in the White House. The idea that you would have a colleague engaging that conduct, you know, is something that is unthinkable. But here you can imagine somebody making the calculus that, you know what, given that the real target here, the person who is most responsible is the former president of the United States, that that's a bargain worth making. These are what are called, by the way, really tough Justice Department decisions. Who do you give immunity to? Is it worth it? Is it better to try and make a criminal case, or do you immunize the person? Really tough calls. And you know, that would be a very tough call, I think, if I were sitting in Jack Smith's shoes.
So, Lisa, this comes back to reporting earlier in the week about DOJ looking at a obstructive conspiracy or a conspiracy to obstruct justice. And we have news reporting of at least two individuals potentially receiving immunity, Kash Patel receiving some limited immunity in the documents case, and a scenario by very credible former prosecutors that Mark Meadows must have had some sort of accommodation or deal. We know he sought a pardon, and just as an entry point, there's that. What does this mean for witnesses like Taylor Budowich? I mean, it seems like the stakes for lying when you don't know who's already flipped are incredibly high.
I think the stakes for Taylor Budowich were incredibly high today. Nicole, if I were a betting person here today, either Taylor Budowich understood that the testimony that was sought from him was very limited and that the prosecutors were trying to make out a case, in fact, that he was duped, much like Evan Corcoran was early on by Trump, that he was essentially an instrument of the crime or fraud. But I'm going to guess that's not what happened here and that Taylor Budowich himself had some form of immunity. Otherwise, his exposure was huge. The statement in question today wasn't the only statement that Taylor Budowich made with respect to the classified documents. He made a statement, for example, right after the Mar-a-Lago search in August. He also accused the FBI of colluding with the Washington Post in its reporting that among the documents that were found were those that talked about the nuclear secrets of foreign nations. So I do think that Taylor Budowich likely had some exposure before he went in today. Whether he still has some exposure after that limited testimony remains to be seen. Certainly, we don't have reporting on that yet, and I and others are waiting with bated breath to see.
Basil, we're talking about the slow sort of grinding wheels of justice and the rule of law, but it sort of stands in a split screen with what we just played, which is Chris Christie, Trump's one-time sort of advisor and apologist for much of Trump's presidency, calling Trump's America a banana republic.
Yeah, first of all, I hate that term because as a person from the West Indies, they always used to talk about that as a banana republic, and we're not. But that said... Something that the point that you made before really is sticking with me about your advice in the White House, or someone who would advise you in the White House. When I started in politics, I imagine most people do, they have some kind of advisor or mentor. Mine always used to say, you can never defend the indefensible. That goes for you, the operative, but it also goes for the person for whom you work. And what is clear to me over and over again in everything that we've been watching is how willing Trump's advisors and supporters were to do the indefensible and try to get away with it and try to sell it to the American people as this is your king, not your president, but your king, and you should obey and respect your king. And now they all seem to be sort of falling on their sword, probably certainly too late for me. But it always goes back to this point about holding people accountable. And what is important for me in the evaluation of the candidates on the GOP side who are running for president, are they going to be willing to go to the White House if they get elected and talk about finding a way to filter all of these people out of government and create some kind of ethics umbrella that makes sure that this doesn't happen again? Or are they going to go and actually take advantage of what Trump has already laid down? And that's the concern, because you can talk about it all you want on a campaign trail. You can be as bold as you want with some repercussions. But once you actually get to the White House, are you actually willing to put something in place that makes it so that you don't exert the same power and reckless influence that Donald Trump did when he was there? And I don't know that anybody is showing me that right now.
Well, and this is something we've come back to. I think Matt Miller was the first person maybe 6 years ago to talk about, you know, oh, the norms. I mean, this is the absolute impotence of norms to protect the country from Trumpism. And I think something that you brought to our attention falls into this category as well. And that is the idea 1 year ago, inconceivable to the head of the PGA, that LIV Golf would subsume the tour. We had him a year ago talking about two families that he knew specifically that had lost loved ones in 9/11, and making that an example and a reason why PGA Tour players should not join the LIV Golf Tour. And we have this blockbuster news this week that they have merged.
What we've seen is Trump has sent a command climate in this country that is showing that integrity is dead. America is for sale. Patriotism is dead, at least among some key leaders. That's why I've continued to say to you, Trump is not a political story. It's a national security story. It's always a national security story. So is LIV Golf. So is the January 6th investigation. We're talking about whether or not
the documents,
all of it, right? We're talking about whether or not a president and a group of people conspire to violently overthrow our government, and whether they should be stopped from doing it potentially again and encouraging others to do it again. Stuart Rhodes is going to jail for 20 years. I think it should be much more. But this goes far and deep, and we don't know how far and deep yet. But we have to remember that even if he loses, he's still a national security threat because he's never been held accountable, and neither has anyone else. And it sends a message to the world that we are willing to sell our top sports league to a bunch of people who are connected to the worst attack on U.S. soil in history, who violate human rights, who criminalize anybody who's LGBTQ. They just bought the PGA, right? And the people like Tiger Woods, who showed integrity, people like Rory McIlroy, who had patriotism and integrity, they got the rug ripped out from under them, just like the 9/11 first responders did by the PGA, who spit in our faces. They said, we're going to roll you. We don't care about you. We are cowards. And I think what they've done is worse than just hypocrisy. It's treasonous.
In fact, there are many that are trying to make this false equivalency between the joining of leagues to create the modern NBA and a modern NFL. No. That is not what's happening here. What's happening is that it is a partnership with a foreign entity. And that foreign entity, as you've laid out, has very questionable human rights with respect to the LGBT community, to women. I worked with a lot of 9/11 families, as you have. And I did so after, with Senator Clinton after 9/11. And to read their response, we should, as a country, be focused on what they are feeling and saying about their concerns around this partnership. Where will it end, if at all? It can't just be about the money. It's got to be more about integrity and our history and who we hold, you know, who we hold up in our nation.
Yeah. Forget about whitewashing history, as Ron DeSantis is trying to do, which is shameful and a sin, and it should be a political crime for which he pays a political price. But this is history that isn't three decades old. And some would like to erase this city's very recent, very painful, very raw history. It's a real, I think to your point, it's a real inflection point on whether we have the capacity, if we really just say never forget, or if we have the capacity to actually never forget. It's really important.
It's gut check moment.
Yeah,
it's gut check
totally.
Time. People say they never forget.
And it knows no part.
And now we're finding
out
who never forgot, and we're finding out who really forgot. And hold them accountable. Boycott the PGA. Put the criminals in jail. Investigate who needs to be investigated. But bring back integrity and celebrate leaders and empower leaders who are willing to carry that message forward.
I appreciate your voice on this today. Basil sticks around. Lisa Rubin, Andrew Weissman, and Paul, thank you so much for starting us off this hour. Basil's around for the whole hour. When we come back, we get another reminder today that the justices on the U.S. Supreme Court are left to police themselves almost entirely. And as the drip, drip, drip about Clarence Thomas has shown, it isn't exactly working out for anyone except Clarence Thomas. We'll explain after a quick break. And later in the broadcast, the House Democrat who forcefully blew the whistle on the right wing's demonization of trans kids and their families.
And one of the things that you said in your information here that you provided was that the dangers of ESG include promoting gender transitions for children. And I want to know, do you really believe that garbage?
Congresswoman Becca Ballant, who eviscerated that former Trump official in a hearing on Capitol Hill, will be our guest later in the hour. Deadline White House continues after a quick break. Don't go anywhere.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
For anyone still worried that the justices on the nation's highest court were still not taking concerns that they are ethically compromised seriously, after scandal rocked the court, those fears might actually be getting worse over the last 48 hours. That is because instead of demonstrating to the public that they are taking ethics issues and lapses seriously, two justices failed to file their ethics disclosures by today's 1 p.m. deadline. And they are Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, who has asked for more time to file his annual financial disclosures following criticism that he failed to report luxury travel and real estate transactions with Texas billionaire and Republican donor Harlan Crow, and Justice Samuel Alito, who also delayed his disclosure this year. It comes on the heels of statements by Harlan Crow's attorney in a letter to the Senate Judiciary Committee after the committee requested Crow's testimony, arguing that Congress does not have the power to supervise the ethics of the court. He writes this, quote, to reiterate, Congress does not have the power to impose ethics standards on the Supreme Court. It therefore cannot mount an investigation for the purpose of helping craft such standards. Finally, because the committee has requested information about the leadership of a co-equal branch of government implicating sensitive separation of powers considerations, it must satisfy a higher standard in order to establish a valid legislative purpose for seeking the requested information. On this point, too, the committee's investigation comes up short. In a statement, Senate Judiciary Chair Dick Durbin and Senator Sheldon Whitehouse respond this way, quote, Harlan Crow does not call the shots here. He is not a branch, nor even a member of government, and cannot claim the protections and privileges of one. The Senate Judiciary Committee has clearly established oversight and legislative authority to assess and address the ethical crisis facing the court. All options are on the table moving forward. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse joins us. Senator, I'm glad that the both of you responded in a letter. You read it, and it's not clear if it's audacity or arrogance or ignorance that fuels such words to be put in writing by lawyers representing Harlan Crow. Do you have a theory on the case?
Any one of those would suffice. I think the fact that any one of them could be true and all three might be is pretty clearly demonstrated by the fact that in the last round of Harlan Crow gifts to Justice Thomas, the question was referred to the judicial conference, which then applied a law to make a determination. So what we're doing here as a Congress is to look at how a body established by Congress, the Judicial Conference, implements a law passed by Congress, the Ethics in Government Act. how you can find a separation of powers violation in Congress doing that is a highly imaginative legal act.
Senator, what, if any, information has been revealed or back-channeled, if that even exists, about this delay in filing these ethics reports? It seems that an optimistic and starry-eyed person might think maybe they're finally coming clean, but that certainly hasn't been the pattern or practice.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, the extensions themselves are not the problem. The question is what gets disclosed at the end of the day. And if you're looking at Justice Thomas, he has gone on a long binge of non-disclosure. And now he's got quite a lot of cleaning up to do. And I think he and his lawyers have some interesting questions to ask about what they disclose. They've said they'd update after the latest judicial conference correction that was sent to the Supreme Court. That happened in March. So they do they disclose what's happened since March, or do they disclose the full reporting year that they're obliged to, or does he go back and correct all his previous forms to comply with the correct standard? And I think they're trying to sort their way through all of that. I hope that he's very transparent and he updates all his previous forms and corrects them to comport with the correct judicial standard.
Senator, the investigative reporting that gave us as a public the information about the hidden real estate transactions and the hidden tuition paid to Justice Thomas's dependents, it's documents work. It's indisputable. What is the investigative ambition of the committee in terms of understanding more than just what the documents reveal? And by that, I mean, would you like an investigation that goes into the relationship and other interests? I mean, what else would you like to know?
Well, we're still developing the investigative plan. But for instance, the Finance Committee of the Senate has an extremely legitimate interest in trying to understand the tax ramifications of all of this. In theory, you should file a gift tax form if you're gifting more than $17,000 to someone. And these vacations to Justice Thomas were certainly worth many times that. So what was the reporting? Why did they feel they needed report or not report? There's a whole tax side to this. Was it disclosed as income? How was it treated? All of those questions are highly relevant to proper understanding of the tax code and to the Finance Committee's business. On the Judiciary Committee side, it's more about the operation of the influence machine that Harlan Crowe is a part of, and exactly how many benefits he gave to Justice Thomas and his family. The fact that we have documents about paying his adoptive son, if you will, tuition, paying his mother's rent, paying money indirectly to his wife, and paying for his very expensive multiple vacations, doesn't mean that that's all that he paid for. Mm-hmm. So that's why we've asked for these documents about what else, what other transactions took place between Harlan Crowe and Justice Thomas. At the end of the day, another character named Leonard Leo figures into this, who has a contract with Justice Thomas to sell his book, creating revenues personally for Justice Thomas, while he's also filing briefs at the Supreme Court through fictitious named front groups, while he spent millions of anonymously raised dollars to campaign for the confirmation of Justice Thomas's new 6 Republican majority.
It just feels like every rock that is turned over is more evidence that real oversight would actually benefit the court and its reputation with the American public, which is plunging. It doesn't have much farther to go. Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, thank you very much for jumping on and spending some time with us on this today. We will stay on it.
Thank you.
When we come back, the right wing's unyielding assault on trans kids and their families just might have finally met its match. How our next guest took on the lies and disinformation and fear mongering on the right in a hearing on Capitol Hill. We'll show it to you next.
I want to know, do you really believe that garbage?
It's not about believing, it's a matter of fact.
So you believe that investing strategies are actually a secret, it's weaponized to support and promote gender transition for children. I just want to, is essentially that what you're saying? Or do you just use it as another opportunity to beat up on children? So do you believe this?
I'm not the one beating up on children. It's the people who are promoting gender transitions in children that are potentially harming them.
It feels like every single hearing that I am in, whether it is in oversight or whether it is in budget or whether it is in a subcommittee, somehow the witnesses find a way to bring in trans children into whatever conversation we're trying to have here.
That was the powerful rebuke yesterday by our next guest, Democratic Congresswoman Becca Ballant, shutting down a former Trump official and Republican climate and energy expert witness who called her own lies a, quote, matter of fact. And that was just one of two House oversight hearings yesterday focused on a corporate strategy that Republicans falsely claim promotes gender transition care for children, their latest weapon in a seeming charade against wokeness to target and exploit transgender children and their families and their rights. Ballant went on to explain to the witness that only a half hour before her lies were told, she had stepped out of the hearing to speak to parents of transgender kids who are being targeted by policies and policymakers in their own states. They asked her, she says, to simply stand up for them against such attacks. Joining our conversation is Congresswoman Becca Ballant, a Democrat from Vermont. Basil is still with us. Congresswoman, thank you so much for being here. We have tried really hard to, in real time, fact check the attacks on trans kids and their parents and their families, and where we've been able to lift up the voices that really simply say, just back up and please give me a moment of grace to try to support my kid. This is hard. We've tried to do that. If you could just start with what you started yesterday, the fact checks. What to you is the most pervasive lie being told by the right? And what is the most effective way of fact checking that?
So one of the most pervasive lies is that we on the left are forcing children into gender changes. This is the lie that they promote, and they sometimes call us pedophiles, they call us groomers. And what they do is they make the parents complicit in this. And these parents are just trying to support their kids in the best way that they know possible, and that is to love them and support them. And these parents have said to me a number of times, I've had the honor to meet with them, and what you said is true. They just want some grace. They just want the space to love their kids and support their kids. And the Republican Party has decided that this is a winning issue for them. And the New York Times did an expose a couple months ago on just exactly how they chose this. This is not random. This is calculated. What could we do to raise donors, to raise engagement among our right-wing base? And they picked trans children and their families. And it is a sickening testimony about where we are right now as a nation, that picking on children is seen as the right way to go in shoring up your base.
I also, if you dig, and it takes a minute, I think most parents of trans kids trying to do what you just described, support their kids and seek medical advice and in some instances, psychological advice, it doesn't necessarily know partisan divides. This is an Ohio Republican making some of the very same points. Let me show this to everybody.
There are Republicans, there are Christians who have transgender children. The people wanting to ban gender-affirming care have no idea what it is like to be transgender or to have a transgender child. This is not something that's done on a whim. It's a deep-rooted dysphoria that, yes, even has spiritual elements to it. My son has a masculine soul, and he said he's felt this way since he was five. You've got to go easy on this. This is a terrible bill. This is not the simple issue being portrayed by the anti-trans people.
I guess I want to lift that up because this I'm still trying to unpack how this became this virulent right-wing political cause when parents of trans kids, you don't know any partisan affiliation when you're trying to support your kids. How important is it in this moment, and you just met with these families of trans kids, how important, how desperate is it to sort of hit pause and get some more facts out there?
Oh, absolutely. And that is one of the things that they have said to us, which is we need your help in helping to educate the public about who we are, who our kids are, how it is that our government is oppressing us. I talked to parents from Alabama and from Texas and from Florida, and they were saying we have to try to explain to our children that their own government is attacking them. And as 11-year-olds, 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds already just grappling, I'm a former middle school teacher, right? These kids are already grappling with who they are, who they want to be in the world. And it is just devastating that these parents and these kids don't feel like they have allies standing up for them. And that was one of the things that was so clear to me after I met with them yesterday and went back into my committee room. They're talking to me that I have a platform, I have a megaphone, I need to use it because they're exhausted from being the ones out there trying to educate people on their lives, and they're just trying to live their lives.
You know, Congresswoman, I got a window, and I don't usually do this, but I covered a Southern Poverty Law Center report on hate, and it was completely rooted in the facts. I actually had to pull some of the anecdotal evidence out of them. It really was data-driven. These are the facts on Republican-led anti-LGBTQ legislation just this year. 525 bills introduced in 41 states, 220 pieces of legislation targeting transgender people, 76 anti-LGBTQ laws have been enacted so far successfully. This is Human Rights Campaign data. There are 1.2 million trans people in the United States, according to the New York Times. And around one of the issues that has a lot of heat on the right, student athletes, there are 100 trans athletes, according to Newsweek. What, in your view, explains the ferocity and the zeal to attack anyone that wants to lift up this Republican from Ohio or the families you just met with? Why is the right so angry?
Well, it sells. Unfortunately, fear and anger sells. And that is the heart of this, really. But this is the backlash. I mean, so I knew when I was 11 years old that I was gay. And that was in the 80s when I was really wrestling with that. And I didn't have any role models for being an out gay politician. So I had a different career in teaching for a long time. But the messages I got were that I was, you know, a horrible person that was deserving of hate. And we made so many games around equality for queer and gay people across the country. We got marriage equality. And this is the backlash from that, because most Americans have moved on from that debate. So they're looking for another boogeyman, and they have settled on trans kids.
I hope that we can let this be the first of many conversations, because I think you can think this doesn't affect you, but I think if you sit by and permit the dehumanization of a family that may not look like yours or be going through the same things, you're maybe missing an opportunity to be part of the solution. So hopefully to be continued. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. To be continued. When we come back, the dangerous smoke that has swamped cities up and down the eastern seaboard, including this one. We'll have a live report on where it's heading, how long it will last, and how you can stay safe next.
From Freakonomics Radio, a new series about a role model we didn't know we needed.
So many crazy things really did happen to him.
The physicist Richard Feynman was one of the most brilliant scientists of his generation, but he was also a troublemaker, an obsessive, and a man who spoke truth to power. Along the way, he created a blueprint for how to lead a life of honest inquiry.
He was a brilliant theoretical physicist, but what really made him stand out was his humanity.
The curious, brilliant, vanishing Mr. Feynman on Freakonomics Radio.
Because if it's 5:54, there's more breaking news to share with you. Here's what it is today. This is reporting from my colleagues at NBC News, Jonathan Dienst and Laura Jarrett, who report that two sources familiar with the matter say this. Steve Bannon was sent a grand jury subpoena in connection with the January 6 investigation. The subpoena was sent out in late May. The subpoena is from the grand jury sitting in Washington, D.C. As we know, as we've been discussing over the last 2 hours, Special Counsel Jack Smith has been using a D.C. grand jury to investigate the events that led to the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. The January 6th Special Counsel investigation is, of course, separate from the ongoing investigation in the classified documents case, which we have also been talking about. My colleagues report that prosecutors are seeking testimony and documents. I want to turn to the story that we teased, the story that has consumed every conversation, big and small, with people familiar and strangers on the street, and that is the smoke that has engulfed New York City and much of the eastern seaboard and parts of the Midwest today. Smoke heading south from the raging Canadian wildfires that have turned the big city into a big orange today. New York City has the worst air quality on the planet, on the entire world today, with 98 million people in 18 states from New Hampshire to South Carolina under air quality alerts. I want to bring in my friend and colleague, NBC News meteorologist Bill Cairns.
Nicole, I mean, this smoke is just a surreal scene. People have never seen anything like it. It's like a bad sci-fi movie. Everyone wants to know, when's it going to get out of here? We are in a hazardous air quality right now, which means everyone should have a mask on outside. They canceled the Yankee game tonight. There's a problem getting into the airports. It will get out of here, but not anytime soon. It's not going to be till Saturday that we'll finally see the smoke plume clearing to the east. In the next 2 to 3 days, we'll have areas of smoke from New York to D.C. tomorrow morning especially. We're going to have a plume of heavy smoke from Detroit, heading down towards Cleveland, possibly Pittsburgh, as we go through Friday. So we're not done yet, Nicole. This is, you're looking at it, the worst air quality day in New York City's recorded history. And we're feeling the effects of it. Watery eyes, coughing, you get the picture.
Anybody needs a mask, I will personally deliver one if you're local here in New York City. Bill Cairns, thank you so much for joining us. A quick break for us. We'll be right back. Thank you so much for letting us into your homes during these extraordinary times. We are grateful.
Hey, this is Jeff Lewis from Radio Andy. Live and uncensored, catch me talking with my friends about my latest obsessions, relationship issues, and bodily ailments. With that kind of drama that seems to follow me, you never know what's going to happen.
You can listen to Jeff Lewis live at home or anywhere you are. Download the SiriusXM app for over 425 channels of ad-free music, sports, entertainment, and more. Subscribe now and get 3 months free. Offer details apply.